creating existence.
Thanks, Luca, and thanks also very much to Luca for organizing this conference. This is a terrific end to my stay here, and thanks to Hugh for inviting me to stay in the first place. Okay, so yeah, the talk I'm going to give today, in a way, it's sort of what I'm trying to do here is to get down to bare bones a lot of the kinds of arguments I've been making in various places lately that sort of push for a different approach to doing ontology, doing metaphysics, than has really been commonplace for the last, I don't know, 60 years or so. And it's an approach that, as you'll see, resembles in some ways the approach that Jonathan was arguing for yesterday. So the scope here of the argument I'm going to give is really very big, and you'll find it quite quick at times. Some of these theses I've argued for in more detail elsewhere, but I want to sort of at least give the big picture. So ontology, of course, is generally conceived of as attempts to answer the question, what exists? Right? And of course, we could start with sort of Quine's joke answer, everything, that, while universally agreed upon, didn't get us very far. And that's been sort of the beginning and the end of agreement on the subject. So in work on ontology lately, of course, we've seen people trying to answer questions, a whole variety of questions, like, are there numbers? Are there propositions? Are there fictional characters? Are there artifacts? Are there biological entities? And so forth. And, of course, there's been little agreement about the right answers, and we've seen sort of a surprising variety of answers to the existence question, ranging from those who would accept even the existence of, say, fictional characters and possibilia, to those who would deny the existence even of, say, all material objects whatsoever. And then there are those who draw the line in surprising places, accepting the existence of, say, biological entities but not artifacts, or apple trees but not apples. There have been maybe slightly more agreement about how we should go about answering these existence questions than there has been about the existence questions themselves. I mean, the core approach, of course, as everybody knows and has been discussed a lot already at this conference, has been Quine's approach to ontological questions, which at least considered as a decision procedure, there's different ways of interpreting it, of course, is based on the idea that we should accept as existing only those entities over which we must quantify if our best scientific theories are to be rendered true. Beyond Quine's approach, there have been various other sort of substantive criteria for existence that have been proposed. Probably the most common of these, one sort of defended by David Armstrong and a lot of others, is the Eleatic criterion, that is, that something exists only if it has causal powers. Again, there's different ways of interpreting this I'll talk about below. That what exists must be mind-independent, in some sense, again, different interpretations. Those, I think, are the two most common by far. Sometimes, though, you get other suggestions. Certain kinds of epistemic criteria are sometimes proposed, that the entities be trackable or observable, or things of which we're capable of being ignorant or in error. Crawford Elder has recently proposed, as a sort of variation from the mind-independent criterion, he thinks that entities, or kinds of entities more precisely, exist only if they possess a genuine nature, where that's a matter of having essential properties whose status as essential is mind-independent. Okay, and so on. So we get all these different sort of substantive criteria for existence that are sometimes proposed, as well as methods for answering the question, what exists? Okay, what I'm going to argue here today is that if we accept three fairly simple and straightforward, and I think at least superficially plausible, theses about language, along with some sort of fairly plausible examples of their application, it's going to follow that all that's wrong. It's going to follow that we should reject Quine's criterion of ontological commitment, at least consider it only as providing, at best, a sufficient condition for ontological commitment, not a necessary condition for ontological commitment. It's also going to follow that we should reject all of the, at least commonly proposed, substantive criteria for existence, like those I just listed, and I think raise severe suspicions against the idea that there could be any such substantive criterion. It will also follow that this sort of standard technique for doing ontology since Quine of trying to show that you're not committed to a certain kind of entity by showing how you can paraphrase away sentences that apparently quantify over the offending kind of entity into sentences that don't, that these kinds of paraphrases really don't help us avoid ontological commitments at all, so the paraphrase strategy really does not help. It will also follow that at least a great many, maybe the majority, of particular arguments against particular kinds of entities that rely on these entities' sort of failure to meet one of the proposed substantive existence criteria are wrong, so those who argue against mathematical entities on grounds of their failure to have causal powers, or who would argue against artifacts on grounds of their mind dependence, and so on, those are all wrong-headed. Finally, from these three theses about language, a straightforward way of approaching existence questions, it's not the same as either, as I'll criticize, obviously, will fall out. It will show a way in which existence questions can be very sort of simply and straightforwardly resolvable. In fact, it'll turn out to be so straightforward and so simple to resolve existence questions that it'll turn out that there's very little room left for a philosophical discipline of ontology, if you think of that as a sort of specifically philosophical study of what really exists. And so we'll have to try to sort of reconceive what, if anything, we could be doing in ontology, or perhaps more broadly in metaphysics at all. Okay, now, I know that none of these three theses is universally accepted, and I'm not going to have space to fully defend any of them here. This is why I said there's a bit of a sort of sketchiness to this. I have done more elsewhere to try to sort of at least expand upon, explain what I mean by, and defend theses 2 and 3. But here I'll just begin by trying to at least make them initially plausible and make it sort of more or less clear what the hell I mean by them. Then the sort of main work of this paper will be not to argue for these three theses, but to show how these conclusions fall out of accepting these three theses. Now again, as I say, I know not everybody accepts them, but the payoff at the end of the paper, I hope, will be at least to show ways in which the practice of ontology, as it's been done over the last 60 years or so, relies on denying the conjunction of these plausible theses about language. So even those who reject the theses, in a sense, they have their sort of work cut out for them. They know what they must do, which is to show which of these theses they're denying and why. And if these theses really are, you know, prima facie plausible, then sort of the burden proof is on them to say why it is that we should really reject them, and then we can preserve their method of doing ontology. Okay, so that's the plan. As you can see, the quarry is big, so I'd best dive in and get started. Start with thesis 1. Star K refers if and only if K's exist. First, let me say what I mean by star K notation there. I'm just following Horwich there. The star quotes are a way of indicating that the term K is to be individuated not merely phonologically or typographically, but rather in terms of meaning. Okay, now, because the old-fashioned quotes, it's not exactly clear what individuative principles are supposed to apply. I hope that thesis 1 sort of looks like a platitude anyway to most people. But if it doesn't, we can work our way up to it from what's, I hope, even more obviously a platitude about reference. There's a platitude about reference for most general nouns. I'm going to just speak in terms of general nouns throughout the talk here, just to keep things streamlined and simple. Most of what I say can also be applied to the case of singular terms. That requires a few additional arguments. I'll leave that off to one side here just to keep things straightforward. Also, when I say a platitude about reference for most general nouns, there's some complications that arise, of course, for context-sensitive terms. Horwich has a sort of story about how to handle those. Let's just put those to one side, too, just to keep the sort of big picture in view and keep it simple for here. Okay, so a platitude about reference for most general nouns is, if star K refers at all, then star K refers to all and only Ks. We can formalize this as in 1b by saying that for all x, star k refers to x if and only if kx. And from this then, of course, we can get certain conclusions about the connection between reference and quantification in both directions, right? First, that if star k refers, then there is something that's k, and that if there's something that's k, then star k refers and refers to it, of course. If we add in the sort of general Quinean assumption, which has been almost but not entirely universally accepted in those doing ontology, you know, in the last 50 years or whatever, that quantification and existence go together, that k's exist just in case there is some x such that kx, then we can get out of that thesis one, our target, that star k refers if and only if k's exist. Okay, sometimes I'll just need to refer to one of those little sub-principles there, but we'll go mostly with thesis one. Now, the principle in thesis one, star k refers if and only if k's exist, bears a lot of resemblance to this sort of standard metalinguistic way of handling the truth conditions of claims of existence and non-existence, right? And that, of course, to that have been raised some fairly standard objections. So you might think at first glance that those same objections apply to thesis one, and so that we should reject thesis one. Let me say briefly why they don't. The standard objections to, quote, k refers if and only if k's exist as a way of stating the truth conditions of claims of existence and non-existence is that k could refer, and yet k's not exist, say, if k had a different meaning. Well, the use of star quotes is designed expressly to avoid that kind of problem. We're individuating our terms by their meaning so that if we change the meaning of star k, then we have a different term altogether. We no longer have that term at all. And so you can't change the meaning of k and have k refer star k, and yet k does not exist. Right? That's blocked by the use of the star quotes. The second sort of standard line of objection is to hold that k's could exist, but it not be the case that the term, quote, k refers if, say, the term, quote, k itself did not exist, if there were no such term in the language. Now, raising that objection, I think, requires a little bit of sleight of hand, because, of course, the person who utters the platitude or the thesis that k refers if and only if k's exist is clearly presupposing the existence of the term k in order to make the claim in the first place. If we can make that presupposition that the term k exists explicit and reread thesis one as assuming that the term star k exists, then star k refers if and only if k's exist. And nothing bad happens for whatever follows in the rest of my talk about what follows from thesis one. So you can read that as implicitly there. I think that it's implicitly there is already sort of suggested by the use of the term in uttering the statement. If you want, you can go ahead and add in explicitly and everything will be fine. I won't, mostly just because it complicates things and I think it's already sort of presupposed there. Okay, so I think these worries shouldn't really give us pause about the platitude that is expressed in thesis one. On to thesis two, then. Thesis two, speakers establish application conditions for our general nouns that determine what it takes at sort of the most basic level for them to refer. Now, I think in some cases, this might just seem like an obvious observation about language, say for our descriptive terms. In many cases, our descriptive terms, terms like bachelor, right? We can even go ahead and state out what conditions it takes for bachelor to refer, namely that there be someone who's a man and who's unmarried. This kind of case is even more obviously widespread in our terms for institutional and legal kinds, where we will lay out, say, in the rule books, under what conditions a touchdown is scored. The lawyers will lay out a conditions for under which, what conditions a contract is made, a debt is incurred, et cetera, et cetera. So for most of our institutional and legal kinds, we have these conditions expressly laid out that tell us what it takes for there to be a thing of the relevant kind or for our term to refer. But what looks like an obvious thesis about language, at least if you look at cases like that and do it sort of naively, might seem to become unobvious or even false in the context of certain philosophical theories, right? Of course, causal theories of reference. Those who accept causal theories of reference accept that at least for some of our terms, right, at least for names and natural kind terms, Putnam, of course, thought this applied to the great majority of all nouns. We'll leave that to one side for the moment. Well, those who have been swayed by these theories would say, but look, according to the causal theories, reference isn't determined by whatever conditions speakers associate with the term. Instead, it's determined by real causal relations to the world, right? And so this whole appeal to application conditions might seem to be ruled out by the causal theories of reference, at least for those terms where a causal theory is the most plausible theory. But this sort of quick claim that reference is determined by real causal relations, it mask a certain kind of ambiguity in what we're talking about here. That is, what is it that causal relations are supposed to determine? Are they supposed to determine whether or not a term refers at all? Or are they supposed to determine or help narrow down, at least on a sort of more moderate or hybrid view, what thing it refers to, assuming it does refer? I think a sort of quick bit of reflection suggests that causal relations alone can't determine whether or not a term refers at all. Why not? Well, there's always causal relations between an utterance and stuff out there in the world, even if it's only my own tongue, my clothes, right, whatever, the pollen in the surrounding air. And yet sometimes we think our terms can fail to refer, right? So what's the account of reference failure that's given by standard causal theories of reference? Well, the standard account, of course, is that we can have reference failure if the grounding, the attempted grounding of the term may fail. So, for example, if I'm, say, out in my boat, and I'm pointing down there, and I say, let's call those kinds of fish bubbleheads, right? And all that's really down under my boat is some seaweed and some rubbish on the floor of the lake and so on, then intuitively my term fails to be grounded and fails to refer. Right. Well, why? Well, the reason seems to be because the term was supposed to refer to a kind of fish, or at least a kind of creature, something like that, down there underneath my boat, and there was no such thing. So this requires then appealing to the existence of at least what I'll call here grounding conditions, right? In this case, maybe that there must be some type of creature that's instantiated by all or most of the sample that's pointed at in the grounding situations. And only if that condition, that grounding condition, which is established by the intentions of speakers now, is fulfilled, does the term acquire reference at all? Is the term successfully grounded? So I think we already have to allow in this role for sort of speaker-established conditions to determine whether or not our terms refer, even in the case of something like natural kind terms. Now, these grounding conditions, conditions under which a new term is successfully grounded, also yield what I'm going to call application conditions for the term that'll tell us in any circumstances whether or not our term succeeds at referring. And that is, in any circumstance C, for bobblehead to refer in condition C, the grounding condition must have been met. If it doesn't, then reference is blocked, right, and the term does not refer. And there must, in that circumstance, be the same kind of animal as that referred to in the initial sample. Notice, of course, that the second clause is automatically fulfilled in the grounding situation, so this can be taken to be a general application condition, whether we're in a grounding situation or in a later use situation for reference. So this is a sort of very basic application condition for a sort of would-be natural kind term like bobblehead that must be fulfilled if the term is to refer at all. Notice that it's not a sort of traditional kind of descriptivism. We're not saying that whatever speakers associate with the term bobblehead must therefore be true or anything like that. There's a kind of deference to the world, right, as we've sort of learned some of our terms have learned from the causal theories of reference to whatever the kind of animal is that was in the original sample and so on. So I think we're preserving a lot of the insights of the standard causal theories of reference, but noting that still, look at this. Oh, sorry. Had that a lot there. But still, we do need to allow that there are these kinds of at least very basic sort of what I sometimes call frame level, because they can also defer to real conditions of the world to give you the full conditions that it takes for there to be bobbleheads, for there to be stuff with this DNA or whatever, that are sort of built into the rules of use for the term. Now, it's sometimes suggested that, you know, to people who object to causal theories of reference, who insist that there must be some kind of basic sort of conceptual content to our terms, that the conceptual content just plays a role in reference fixing, right? So, for example, the usual example is we can sort of ground the reference of Smith by saying, call the man with the martini in the corner Smith, even if the guy in the corner doesn't have any martini whatsoever, the term still refers to Smith, and so that can still turn out to be false of him. So that's often said, oh, they play a role in reference fixing, but they don't play any part in the sort of rules of ongoing rules of use for the term, to put it in my terms. But that clearly isn't the case for the kinds of application conditions I'm talking about here, right? These application conditions are conditions that have to be fulfilled if the term is to refer at all, as opposed to just fail to refer, fail to be grounded. So they're not conditions that we can then sort of kick away and say, don't play an ongoing role in the rules of use for the term. Okay, so that was just a sort of quick sketch of trying to plausibilify thesis two. Now on to thesis three. The fact that one statement is true may analytically entail that another is true. Say that A analytically entails B if a competent speaker and reasoner who grasps the meanings of the terms used and who knows the truth of A could legitimately infer B from that basis alone. This, again, I think, is at least superficially just a straightforward observation about the way language works. It's an observation that we can see through, say, speaker commitments, that if a person asserts that there's a dog in the backyard, that she's thereby committed herself to the truth of there's an animal in the backyard. If she accepts that there's a dog in the backyard but denies that there's an animal, then we might legitimately rebuke her, accuse her of contradicting herself, or fail to understand her, assume that she must be joking or using the term in a non-standard way, say using dog to refer to a toy dog, right, rather than a genuine dog, and so on. So this kind of analytic entailment, then, I think becomes obvious first through the kinds of speaker commitments, the way in which you can commit yourself to the truth of one thing by accepting the truth of another. This bears obviously some resemblance to some of the stuff that Britt was just talking about. You can also sort of see the presence of these analytic entailments in ordinary speech through the presence of redundancies. That is, to use the same example, to say that there's a dog in the backyard and there's an animal in the backyard is intuitively redundant, and there's something wrong with saying this, right? Because it's redundant to say there's a dog in the backyard and there's an animal, it violates the Gricean maxim of brevity, right? So it's hard to see under what conditions you could at all sensibly assert it, given that it's redundant. So when you've got this kind of redundancy, I think that's an evidence that you've got an analytic entailment. We can also, given thesis two, let me just get my hand out so I can copy some of my theses in front of me. Given thesis two, we can sort of see why there ought to be this kind of analytic entailment, right? At least some of them. It's clear that these entailments, like the ones I was just talking about, that if there's a dog in the backyard, there's an animal in the backyard, they're not sort of traceable to logic alone. They're traceable to relationships in the meanings of our terms, right? And we can then go back and look at thesis two to say, oh, okay, that makes perfect sense, right? If the rules of our use of our terms may be interrelated, such that, say, dog can only be applied in circumstances in which animal can be applied, then it's clear how you can get this kind of analytic entailment from saying that there is a dog in the backyard to saying that there's an animal in the backyard, right? So you get these sort of relations in the application conditions. And that's one way, at least, I'm sure it's not the only way, of trying to explain how there can be such analytic entailments in language. Now, again, what seems like a sort of superficially obvious observation about language might, to some, come to seem unobvious, even downright false, in the context of certain philosophical commitments, right? I've been speaking about analytic entailments, and while these seem to be fairly obviously present in natural language, in the kinds of redundancies we have, in the way we treat speaker commitments, so that it seems like anyone who denies their existence incurs the burden of proof to say why it is that there really aren't such things, a lot of people think, yeah, and Quine discharged that burden of proof for me, right? And his famous arguments against analyticity in Two Dogmas and also in Truth by Convention. Okay, so I should say a little bit about that. This is something I've said more about elsewhere. First of all, Quine's sort of early arguments in Two Dogmas and in Truth by Convention, I think really much more target a much more specific view. They target the view that there is a behavioral criterion that can be used across the board for distinguishing analytic and synthetic sentences. The idea that there are analytic entailments does not presuppose that there is such a criterion. In fact, first of all, I'm not even talking about analyticity, about analytic claims themselves, but about analytic entailments from one claim to another claim, right? And this does not rely on a notion of synonymy. We can just talk about relationships in the application conditions and the rules of use for our terms as a way of understanding them. Secondly, I'm certainly not presupposing that there is a sort of across the board behavioral criterion for distinguishing these. And then I've argued at some length elsewhere that in Ordinary Objects, a book that came out a few months ago, that Quine's arguments into dogmas especially, but also in Truth by Convention, leave room for a way of understanding analytic entailments as being grounded in relationships of the rules of use for our terms, where these are collectively legislated by speakers. So Quine, as you remember, of course, suggests that one might try to understand analyticity in terms of synonymy, synonymy in terms of definition, but definition we can't just understand as what appears in dictionaries, right? That's just descriptive of synonymies that are already hold. But he suggests there is this way, there's at least one case where it kind of makes sense, where someone explicitly introduces a novel term and says, by P I shall mean, and thus legislates a definition, considering definition as an act of defining rather than a descriptive report of a sort of definition that's already in place and in use. So what I've argued very briefly is that we can understand these kinds of relationships in rules of use for our terms, or rather the rules themselves, which then have these relations, as legislated definitions, legislated by speakers collectively. So we have a sort of collective and diffuse case of legislation rather than an explicit and singular case. But it sort of runs in parallel. I'm sure that's too quick, but Quine comes back to this issue, of course, in his later work, in 1991 paper, Two Dogmas Revisited. And he still has some reservations about analyticity, but he's much softer on it there. He still has reservations about Carnap's use of the notion of analyticity in handling mathematical truth. I'll say nothing about mathematical truth. All I'm concerned about is the kind of analytic entailments in sort of common sense speech. And he's still worried that speaking of analyticity, as he puts it, begets an uncritical notion of meaning or synonymy that can induce a false sense of understanding. As I said, what I'm talking about doesn't require a sort of notion of synonymy at all. But Quine acknowledges there, in the Two Dogmas Revisited, that analyticity undeniably has a place at the common sense level, and that there are certain manifest cases of it in ordinary language. He even there suggests a certain behavioral criterion for distinguishing analytic and synthetic sentences, that analytic sentences are those that speakers learn the truth of just in coming to understand the relevant words. Now, the parallel between that and my criterion for analytic entailments will be fairly obvious, right? Because I'm going to say that analytic entailments are those that a speaker who knows the truth of A can infer the truth of B just on the basis of being a competent reasoner, knowing the truth of A, and knowing the meanings of the relevant terms, or understanding the relevant terms, if you prefer. So it's really quite parallel there. Okay, so right, again, the sort of analytic entailments that are presupposed in thesis 3 are only these sort of manifest, what Quine calls the manifest common sense cases that appear in ordinary language. And our criterion parallels, I said that already. Okay, get ahead of myself. Okay, so those are the three theses, and those are some these very brief, sketchy attempts to defend them against some of the more obvious objections that might come to mind. And I think if you put those aside, they all have at least a fair amount of initial plausibility. So let me now try to bring out the consequences that follow from this. So let's go back to Quine's criterion of ontological commitment, certainly the most widely used sort of principle in ontology and people's attempts to say what it is that exists. So here's the original statement of it, or one of them. We are convicted of a particular ontological presupposition if and only if the alleged presuppositum has to be reckoned among the entities over which our variables range in order to render one of our affirmations true. Okay, and I think most literally understood there, he's just talking about what it is that a particular theory is committed to, or what a sentence is committed to sort of follow Britt's formulation of it. But this also, of course, gets used as a decision procedure if we want to figure out what sentences we accept as true or what theory to accept, and then sort of read our ontological commitments off of that. Ultimately, of course, following Quine to say that we should only accept those entities that our best scientific theories have to quantify over to render them true. And the use of this criterion of ontological commitment, of course, has yielded the paraphrase strategy for doing ontology. This is sort of a quote from Quine that sort of sets it up, that if an apparently committing mode of speech can be paraphrased so as to show that the seeming reference to the offending entities on the part of our bound variable was an avoidable manner of speaking, then we are not really involved in ontological commitments to entities of that kind, right? And of course, this is what has then spurred all these sort of paraphrases of apparent talk about fictional characters, artifacts, propositions, you name it. Right? Okay, but if you accept theses 1 through 3, plus some plausible examples, examples are key, then this is going to show that Quine's criterion doesn't provide a necessary condition for ontological commitment. At best, it's sufficient, and that paraphrases don't relieve a theory of ontological commitments. What's actually most relevant here, most directly, is thesis 3, though theses 1 and 2 are sort of used to shore it up to make it more plausible, these applications. Why? Well, among the sorts of analytic entailments that thesis 3 tells us exist, there are what I'll call existence-introducing analytic entailments. They go from things like this, from saying, a van collided with a car down on King Street last week, right? Two, there was a collision between a van and a car. Now, intuitively, right, A star is redundant with respect to A. It's just a wordier way of saying A. You might just hear A and restate it as A star naturally when somebody says, what did they say? This redundancy and the fact that a speaker who says a van collided with a car is then committed to saying, yeah, there was a collision between a van and a car, suggests that this is a sort of prime case of the kind of analytic entailment that's described in thesis 3. But again, at least on the surface, these two sentences, A and A star, will carry very different ontological commitments on the sort of Quinean criterion, A requiring us only to quantify over vehicles, vans and cars, and A star apparently requiring us to quantify over a new sort of thing, right? A collision, a kind of event rather than a kind of object that wasn't mentioned at all in A, at least, you know, not by a noun term. It won't have escaped your notice. Of course, this is just the same kind of analytic entailment that Luca was talking about yesterday under the sort of pleonastic transformations that are introduced by Stephen Schiffer. So I'm following Schiffer quite a bit here, but with some slightly different examples to make them slightly more ordinary language. Now, I find when I've been sort of defending this kind of view that there's a lot of suspicion out there of the very idea that there may be these kinds of existence-introducing analytic entailments. Right? That seems to be where a lot of people dig in their heels. And it's definitely true that if you can accept thesis 3, that there are some analytic entailments in language, and yet still reject the idea that any of them are like this, are existence-introducing. And if so, then the consequences that I claim follow for Quine's criterion don't go through, right? You're all right. But I think if you find yourself suspicious of existence-introducing analytic entailments, then accepting theses 1 and 2 will ease your worries, or should ease your worries. That is, theses 1 and 2 make it clear why, yeah, we have a reason to expect that among our analytic entailments, some will be existence-introducing in this sense. By thesis 2, right, our ordinary terms come with certain kinds of application conditions that, at least at the very basic level, are established by speakers, what speakers would require for it to be the case for the term to refer. So what are they for collision? Well, the very sort of apparent redundancy between A and A star suggests that according to the sort of standardly associated application conditions for collision star, that these are guaranteed to be met if it's true that a van collided with a car, that that's at least sort of sufficient for collision star collision to apply. Then by 1C, right, if collision refers, where are we? Yep, then there is something that's a collision, we get the quantificational claim, and so by 1, we come to the conclusion that collisions exist. Of course, it's 1C that's crucial for the argument against Quine here. So it looks like we've got grounds for thinking, yeah, of course we should expect there to be this kind of analytic entailment. Moreover, these kinds of existence-introducing entailments are really common in our ordinary talk about existence, right? We quite commonly accept that from the fact that, say, two people sincerely make certain vows, sign certain paperwork in the presence of the relevant authorities, a new kind of thing, right? A marriage comes into existence where there was none before. Or that by building a certain kind of building and consecrating it in a certain fashion, a church may come into existence. Now there's a church where there was none before. These kinds of existence-introducing entailments are also available, as sort of Luca was making clear yesterday, for a great many of the sort of disputed philosophical entities, as well as for sort of common sense entities. So from claims that, as I've argued elsewhere, that only sort of quantify over simples arranged chairwise, right, we can then acquire through these kinds of transformations that if there are simples arranged chairwise, there is a chairwise arrangement of simples, which is just a long-winded way of saying there's a chair, and acquire commitment to chairs, that from the chair is red, we can move to there is a property that the chair has, right? I mean, redness. Similarly for states, we did events with collisions, and you saw those examples, of course, in Luca's talk yesterday. So they seem to be really rife in ordinary language also, but also in these specifically disputed kinds of philosophical case. So these existence-introducing analytic entailments hold where you've got an initial sentence that makes no mention of k's at all, that doesn't use the term k, right? And so doesn't quantify over k things, but which has a kind of analytic entailment that gives us ultimately a claim that entails the existence of k's or the quantification over k's. Okay, so if you accept all that, accepting theses 1 through 3, accepting these particular examples of thesis 3, then it looks like you should reject the paraphrase strategy, as a couple other people have argued in this conference, warming my heart. So eliminativists sort of classically will try to avoid, say, commitment to events by paraphrasing all statements of a form like A star, there was a collision between a van and a car, in terms of claims like A, right, a van collided with a car. But if A can really be sort of trivially transformed into A star, and A star is just redundant with respect to it, then the paraphrase only sort of sweeps the commitment to events under the carpet. You're not really avoiding the commitment. The commitment's implicit already in the assertion of A, right? All you're doing is sort of refusing in the paraphrase to use the noun term A so that the commitment isn't made obvious. At least if we accept that there are these kinds of existence-introducing analytic entailment. Now, you could, of course, reject the idea that there is this kind of analytic entailment between claims like A and claims like A star. That would be rejecting this application of thesis 3. But this comes at a substantial cost, right? Namely, that if you reject that transformation, then you end up treating sentences that in their sort of established English use seem to be equivalent, in just one slightly wordier than the other, as even lacking the same truth value. So if you accept theses 1 through 3, especially 3 in these particular applications of it, then it looks like we should reject the idea that a man frees himself from ontological commitments of his discourse if he shows how some particular use which he makes of quantification involving a prima facie commitment to certain objects can be expanded into an idiom innocent of such commitments. Because if they really are sort of good paraphrases, if they're paraphrases from which we can derive these sort of trivial transformations to claims that commit us to the entities, then we're really implicitly committed to them all along, and we're not avoiding anything by paraphrasing. In short, commitment to entities of a certain kind isn't avoided by avoiding certain terms or concepts. So if a theory treats sentences as true, which, when a new term k is introduced, analytically entail that there are k's, the theory is all along committed to k's, even if it wasn't using the term in the first place. And we should conclude that quantification isn't necessary for commitment. Now, of course, at least if you take Quine, the early Quine, to have been rejecting the idea of analyticity altogether, quite likely he would reject thesis 3, right? Along with analyticity, he would reject the idea that there are analytic entailments. So as I say, I think he really softens on the idea later. And there are probably ways of understanding his earlier stuff that he's not so harsh to begin with. So I'm certainly not trying to show that Quine is inconsistent or anything like that, or that from a sort of purely Quinean perspective, where you would deny analyticity, that you should deny or reject the criterion of ontological commitment. Instead, what I'm trying to show is that those who find theses 1 through 3 plausible then have reason to doubt Quine's criterion and to reject the paraphrase technique used in ontological debates. Okay, next bold claim. The consequences of theses 1 through 3 for these various attempts to draw out sort of substantive existence conditions. There's a great many different criteria for existence that are often proposed, right? As I said earlier, that the entities must have causal powers to really exist, that they must be mind independent. Lakoff, for example, says existence can't depend in any way on human cognition. And Jody Azzouni, while he denies that there are any good philosophical arguments for any particular existence conditions, thinks that our society does have one that's sort of built into our use of the term exists, that it's ontological independence from any psychological or linguistic process whatsoever. And as I said before, you sometimes get others proposed, like possession of a real nature in elders' terms, or various forms of epistemic robustness, trackability, observability, and so on. Okay, now if you accept theses 1 and 2, then it's fairly easy to show that each of these proposed criteria is wrong. You can show that they're wrong if you can find a case in which the standard application conditions for some term, star K, are fulfilled. In that case, by thesis 2, star K refers, and by thesis 1, K's exist, but where K's don't meet the proposed existence criterion, you got something existing that doesn't meet the criterion, too bad for the criterion. Okay, so here's some quick, no doubt, two quick examples. Rejecting mind independence. Consider, again, some common sense terms like table, painting, baseball, money. The application conditions that standard English speakers associate with these terms seem pretty obviously to be met. Those for table seem to be met right here in this room, for painting in art museums the world over and many households, baseball for money in your pocket and so on. Even if we can't lay out in detail and sort of explicitly say what the application conditions are, it's pretty clear that a situation in which I've got $5 in my pocket is a case in which money applies, for example, and that sometimes happens. Okay, so it seems like these terms refer then according to the standardly accepted application conditions, and so it seems like we ought to say by thesis one that tables, paintings, baseball, and money exist. But all of these require for their existence that there be certain kinds of intentional actions or practices, collective beliefs and practices. In the case of money, people accepting stuff that counts as money. In the case of table, the intentions of those who make and use tables, perhaps. We could spell it out in more detail if we had the time. So all of these appeal to, require the existence of minds, of intentional acts or psychological processes of some kind to exist. So they can't be mind independent. So they exist, but the mind independence, mind independence doesn't apply to them, so we should reject the mind independence criterion. Of course, you might try to reconstrue mind independent in various different ways. You might try to require with Elder having a mind independent nature rather than mind independent existence, or having a certain kind of epistemic independence. Crawford Elder actually proposes this in his 89 paper. I won't have time to go into those sorts of possible avenues here, though I've done so elsewhere. I've argued that artifacts, to name but one example, also violate these criteria. They can't be thought to have mind-independent natures in Elder's sense, or to be fully epistemically independent of us in the way that people like Elder require. But the sort of normally associated application conditions for artifactual terms are met in spades, and so we have reason to say that they exist despite their failure of mind independence in any of these senses. What of the Eleatic criterion? Well, this is often interpreted as requiring that for entities to exist, they contribute some novel causal powers over and above those that anything else would contribute. And of course, there's some sort of standard arguments that ordinary objects, tables and chairs and sticks and stones, fail to meet that criterion. Vandenbergen thinks this. He just says it briefly. I don't think he argues it in detail. Trenton Merricks argues it in more detail. But of course, again, the ordinary application conditions established by speakers for table terms like table and stone, barring radical conspiracy theories, seem clearly to be fulfilled, whether or not it turns out that these contribute novel causal powers above those of their parts arranged table-wise. And so, by theses 2 and 1, we should allow that they exist, despite violating the criterion. Some interpret the Eleatic criterion, I think, more plausibly, not as requiring that for entities to exist, they contribute novel causal powers, or causal powers over and above those of any other entity or of their parts, whatever the over and above means, but just that they have some causal powers. But even so, we can look to other sorts of terms, terms for sort of abstract social and cultural entities. I'll stick with those because those are more common sense terms that we know what we're doing with, and leave some of the more philosophically disputed cases to the side. But terms like law, debt, story, symphony are apparently met, right? In this country, there are laws. There are many people who are in debt, and so on. There's symphonies that are performed. So it seems, according to the ordinary application conditions, those terms do refer, and so stories, symphonies, laws, and debts exist, but as sort of abstract entities, they can't be thought themselves to possess causal powers, though, of course, you know, beliefs about debts and enforcement of laws and so on has a great many important causal powers. So again, they violate the criterion, though given 2 and 1, we have reason to say they exist. So much the worse for the criterion. The underlying mistake behind that's sort of made by those who try to find a substantive criterion for existence, like possession of causal powers, mind independence, and so on, seems to be sort of starting with too narrow a range of terms in view. Finding an existence criterion that's suitable for things of one kind, say basic physical entities, perhaps those do have to be mind independent or have causal powers and so on, or there have to be such things in order for our terms to refer. But then they adopt it across the board as a criterion for the existence of anything whatsoever. But a more sort of careful attention to the way language works suggests that different terms have different application conditions, yielding different existence conditions for different sorts of things, so that we shouldn't expect there to be any one single sort of substantive condition on the world that's required for things of any sort to exist. So as a result, am I out of time? No, there's a phone. Okay. As a result, the prospects seem dim. Given the sort of real diversity in the application conditions speakers associate with our terms and the relationship between the fulfillment of those in reference and claims about the existence of the entities, prospects seem dim for finding a single universal requirement for the application of our terms. And so, given 1 and 2, we should reject most of the arguments for eliminating things of various sorts, for eliminating fictional characters on grounds of their mind dependence, for eliminating mathematical entities on grounds of their failure to have causal powers, and so on. Finally, then, the consequences of all this for ontology. Well, you might, if you've come with me this far, think, look, if I've bought into all you've told me up till now, then it looks like we're really stuck, right? If we can't use Quine's criterion to address existence questions, and we can't use any of the sort of standard, obvious, substantive criteria for existence, how can we address existence questions at all? Are we just stuck accepting the existence of any old thing that anybody might care to mention, phlogiston, witches, and the like? And if we are, then this might be seen as a clear reductio of theses 1 through 3 with which I began. But hopefully it's obvious that that's not the case. That in fact, accepting theses 1 through 3, actually it's 1 and 2 alone that are important for this bit, accepting theses 1 and 2 gives us a very sort of straightforward method of addressing existence questions. Do k's exist? First, determine the frame level application conditions for star k. What would it take, according to the conditions standardly associated with speakers, for this term to refer? And that's a bit of conceptual analysis, which though will also, you can do by sort of semantic descent, give you the existence conditions for things of the kind. Then determine whether or not these application conditions are fulfilled. If they are, then by thesis 2, the term refers, and by thesis 1, k's exist. If not, not. But the substantive conditions it'll actually take for things of kind k or j or l or whatever to exist will vary as the application conditions for the terms vary. So it's easy to see that on this view, we're not committed to the existence of phlogiston, witches, and the like. The trouble with these terms is that the application conditions were not fulfilled, right? That when phlogiston was used, was sort of introduced, was supposed to refer to that kind of chemical that's released during combustion. There was no such kind of chemical. Speakers made a mistake. The application conditions associated with the term weren't fulfilled. The term wasn't properly grounded. There is no phlogiston. Similarly, witch was supposed to refer to women who made pacts with the devil and in virtue of that had certain supernatural powers. But in the absence of that devil and or powers, right, witch doesn't refer, there are no witches. So we do have grounds for denying the existence of things where speakers are making this kind of mistake in thinking that the application conditions they standardly associate with the term are fulfilled, but it just turns out they're not. What we don't have is room for denying existence on grounds of failure of purported entities to meet some philosophically proposed existence criterion. So, existence questions, as we sort of traditionally have pursued them in ontology, turn out on this model to be deflated. They're answerable straightforwardly through a combination of conceptual analysis, figuring out the application conditions, and empirical inquiry, seeing if they're fulfilled. the empirical side might not always be easy. Actually, maybe neither side's easy, but it's at least straightforward. And there's little room for ontology considered as a specifically philosophical discipline of figuring out what really, really exists. So what's left to do? Well, obviously, there's some work left to be done in terms of conceptual analysis, the analysis of individual terms or concepts, what it is that the relevant, what the relevant application conditions are for our terms, and how these are interrelated, right? Whether artifact presupposes the existence of, the application of artifact presupposes the existence of a maker or user of these things, for example. And by undertaking, of course, you might want to say, well, but metaphysics wasn't supposed to be about our terms or concepts. It's supposed to be about the world, right? Well, yeah, and that's still okay on this model because we can engage in a kind of semantic descent that takes us from the truths we can uncover through conceptual analysis about the application conditions for our terms to yield the existence conditions for the things, if any, our terms refer to, and from sort of truths about relationships among our concepts or terms to truths about relationships among the entities, if any, that are referred to. I think prominent among these relations that will be of prime interest are those that Jonathan was talking about yesterday, these kinds of dependence relations, right? Which entities are more basic than others? The existence of which entities requires the existence of which others? And we can go about trying to figure out which entities are the most fundamental, right? That's a perfectly reasonable question, or which are more fundamental at least than which others, even if we can't legitimately understand what we're doing ontology as figuring out what really exists. Okay, so some conclusions then. As I said, I'm well aware that not everybody will accept theses 1 through 3. But those who find, at least my arguments are correct, those who find the conclusions intolerable will have to reject the conjunction of 1 through 3. And then the work is laid out for them to say which bit particularly they think is false and why we should reject it. Even those, I hope, will find this work of some interest to sort of see the kinds of theses about language that they must rely on rejecting the conjunction of. Those who do find theses 1 through 3 plausible have then reason to be suspicious of the whole way that ontology has been done over the last 60 years or so, and to seek a new understanding of the work of ontology, because existence questions, as we used to think of them, will have been deflated. That's it. Can I just turn this off first so it's not a distraction? Let's see if I can just put it to sleep.
Other questions? I don't remember your name.
Dan.
Okay, your name? No, not you.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, you can start.
Of the consequences of what? Sorry.
Of four-point square theory.
Okay.
The consequences of four-point square theory. First, I'm curious to hear what you would say to a philosopher who denies that A analytically entails A star. So this philosopher would say that it's just not true that the competent speaker grasps concepts can legitimately infer A star from A, because you have things like Holmes, was a detective who lived on Baker Street, therefore there was a detective who lived on Baker Street. That's not going to be legitimately inferred by any competent speaker of English. We philosophers may be corrupted by using classical logic for too long, but someone who likes free logic might say that the problem here is that the conceptual role of there is and there are in English just isn't the same as the conceptual role of backwards E in classical logic. It's just not true that there is translates backwards E. And so no competent speaker would actually make inferences like the one about there being detective on Baker Street from the fact that Holmes was a detective who lived on Baker Street. So that's my first worry.
To address that first then?
Oh,
I still got it in my head? Okay, good. Yeah, so first thing to say is that thesis one would, of course, be denied by free logicians. And then they can resist all the consequences that I say follow for that. In fact, there's two ways of denying thesis one. You can either, of course, deny that the connection between reference and quantification. And Martinich and Stroll, for example, the most recent example I know, they've got this book about fiction where they just deny that. They don't think reference presupposes that you can quantify a relevant sort of thing. Or you can deny the connection between quantification and existence, as other people have done, like Joe Yazuni, my colleague Octavio Bueno, have denied that. In either case, then you lose the thesis. I have to talk to these guys separately, right? They don't have to accept any of the conclusions that I give. Although I think these guys, along with the free logicians, they're in a sense not my target in this paper. Now, what do I say to...
Wait a second. What the philosopher that I'm thinking of doesn't deny thesis one. They say Holmes doesn't refer.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So they'd accept these equivalences, but deny that Holmes refers.
Sorry.
They'd accept the equivalences in thesis one, but deny that Holmes refers.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, fair enough then. Then I am talking to that person. Then what do I say to them when they say that we can't move from a claim like a van collided with a car to there was a collision between a van and a car because the parallel move, Sherlock Holmes lived at Baker Street to there was a detective who lived at Baker Street, clearly doesn't work. Well, as you said yourself, that latter inference is one that any well-informed speaker of English would never make. And I think the reason that we would never make that is because we do understand a lot of claims about fiction as being implicitly prefixed with an according to the story operator. And that is claims especially like there's this detective and so on. And because we implicitly understand them as prefixed with the story operator, then we know that that's a false move. Notice that accepting the paraphrase of Sherlock Holmes lived at 110B Baker Street, whatever it is, as according to the story this paraphrase isn't motivated by avoiding an ontology of fictional objects. So I'm not sort of participating in the paraphrase strategy for the reasons that I object to others using it. Instead, it's motivated by the fact that otherwise we get sort of straightforward inconsistencies with obvious empirical truths about the world and with other things we want to say about fiction, like that Sherlock Holmes is a fictional character and so on. In the case of the kinds of entailments that I'm relying on to argue against Quine's criterion of ontological commitment, like A to A star, competent speakers would accept them straightforwardly, but have no idea what you're talking about if you sort of refuse the second having said the first, and so on. So I think we do have evidence that this is a legitimate move in those cases, even though in the sort of fiction cases it's not, and for drawing the line between those.
So this would reward thesis four, something about there being an implicit fictional operator.
At least to handle that kind of objection. Yeah, that's right. So it also requires a certain way of handling fictional discourse in order to avoid that kind of apparent parallel from being a genuine parallel.
Okay, so now about the paraphrases that you say are not going to be useful here. The way I'm thinking, the eliminativist about events who doesn't want to accept collisions in their ontology, it's not that they're trying to paraphrase A star into A, rather they accept that A commits you to collisions and therefore to events, but they'll try to paraphrase A into some B. B may be something like a van and a car, you know, we're not in contact at T, and a van and a car, the same van and the car, the same car, this would have to be spelled out. We're in contact at T plus one, and you'll have to say some more stuff about T and T plus one. But that's the kind of paraphrase they would like to produce, paraphrase for A, and then this would be B, and B would not entail A star. That's what they would propose.
Right, okay, so you're quite right. That's the sort of strategy that people would use, and that the entailment then becomes much less obvious than the A and A star that I've got on your handout. I still do think that this kind of paraphrase, at least if it's any good, if it's going to be at all adequate to sort of
capture what was true about the original claim, will end up committing you to collisions. And this is where a strategy, I mean, here we've got just sort of variants of the same term, right, collided and collision. What you're doing is sort of getting rid of anything resembling that term at all, and talking about spatial interactions of vehicles or whatever.
But also about having properties at one time and then
having properties at another time. Fine, right. So we avoid appearance of a reference to events. Even in those cases, and the sort of details would have to be drawn out separately when the paraphrase is produced and I'll have to make my argument, but what's going to happen, I think, is that if this is at all adequate, that the conditions that are described there, vehicle here, vehicle there, now, vehicle here, vehicle there, dents, etc., whatever, injuries, that those will be conditions that, according to ordinary speakers, once they figure out what the hell you're talking about, will say, oh, so what you're trying to say is there's a collision, right, that will then analytically entail the existence of a collision, just slightly more subtly. But again, that has to be done sort of on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I've tried to do it with particles arranged chairwise in chairs. That kind of move would have to be done separately, but that's a strategy, I think.
Fine. Okay, Dan.
My question is, similar point. So, I'm wondering how thesis one supported the claim that A star is an analytic consequence of A. So when you get...
Only very indirectly. The sort of direct support for that A star is an analytic consequence of A is really just from thesis three. But then you imagine, I imagine at that stage, that is, these claims are analytic entailments, and the claim is, you also have to accept these examples, as I said, that this is an example of an analytic entailment. Now, the way thesis one comes in is because I imagine an interlocutor, actually I don't have to imagine that I've had some like this, right, says, yeah, I believe in analytic entailments generally, but not these kinds of existence-introducing ones. How the hell can that possibly work? How can you get, you know, a sort of trivial transformation from a sentence that doesn't commit you to collisions, say, or canes, whatever they may be, to one that does? And that's where theses two and one come in. So it's by appeal to saying, look, all it takes for a claim like there was a collision, like the disputed part of A star, to be true, is for, well, we've got to figure out what the application conditions of the collision are, and then see if they're met. What are these application conditions sort of standardly associated with the term? Well, I probably can't give you a nice full set of necessary and sufficient conditions, but one thing's clear, given the way speakers use these terms, right, that A hitting B in the street, vehicles, dents, injuries, whatever, is sufficient for there was a collision, for a collision to apply, and then given thesis one, if collision applies, the application conditions are fulfilled, then, thesis two has that it refers, thesis one says if it refers, then collisions exist.
So it seems like someone who rejected the analytic consequence of A star from A will just deny those application conditions for the word collision.
Right.
It is a collision.
Right. So what are they going to substitute instead? So what the sort of burden of thesis two is to show that, look, whatever the application conditions are, that we say a term has, they've got to be those standard speakers would accept. So what is it then, I would put it back on the interlocutor, what is it that is supposed to be lacking in this case? What is the standard application condition for collision that's supposed to not be fulfilled in this kind of case? Right, where a van collided with a car is true. Then it's up to my interlocutor to say what it is, right? And I'm not sure I can think of a immediately plausible one for that case. I mean, the cases I've dealt with at greater length are those where we get these apparent kinds of entailments between there are particles arranged chairwise and there's a chair. Right? And in that case, what people generally do is to say, look, I think that the condition that isn't met is that there's some object here. In a case where we've just got particles arranged here, that is a chair. So perhaps the parallel would be that there's some event here, right, that is a collision. I've dealt with this sort of case of the term object at greater length elsewhere. Roughly, I think that this is a slightly problematic term, a term that doesn't have application conditions of its own, sort of fixed application conditions, but that's guaranteed to apply, roughly, there's a bunch of different options, but anyway, this is the relevant one, that's guaranteed to apply provided a first-order sorter like chair applies. So that you can't deny that there's an object on grounds, sorry, that there's a chair on grounds of denying that there's an object. Instead, if there's a chair, that analytically entails there's an object. And I guess my sort of temptation would be to think that the debate would go the same way about events. that is, an event is this sort of generic term, right, that covers all sorts of event terms like collision, party, hiccup, whatever it may be, and it's guaranteed to apply provided one of those applies, so that you can't deny that there is a collision on grounds of denying that there's an event. Now, I mean, all this is going to sort of ramify into huge debates about the actual application of the term and how we handle terms like event, but that's sort of the strategy, at least.
Well, what about the proposal that it's something like that there is some object that plays a certain theoretical role, something like that, and then it just turns out that there's no such, you know, object that, that plays that certain that theoretical role? Or it's at least it's debatable.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess I would suspect, and then of course the argument would have to be made, that in that case, what's going on is the philosopher in question, my interlocutor, is sort of substituting our standard event terms and their application conditions, like collision and hiccup and so on, with some that are with different ones that are suitable for theories of theoretical sciences. And then by doing that, they're imposing sort of higher conditions that it takes for there to be an event, right? And on those grounds, then they're denying that there really is a collision. But what I would try to argue is that our sort of ordinary language doesn't involve that kind of commitment to a role in the theory. And so by denying that that's met, the interlocutor does not really give us a case in which there aren't collisions according to our standard use of the term. They give us a case in which there aren't collisions according to their use of the term, which is much inflated. Condition of application requiring a certain role in the theory. And they may be true about their use of the term, but what they're not doing is giving us reason to reject the ordinary use and the ordinary truth expressed in it. And we might have reason for adopting a language even, that's sort of a pragmatic issue.
Yeah. I think you said that instead of substantive existence theories, you're proposing that what are the application conditions for reference to succeed? And application conditions being fulfilled means that the thing exists, is that right?
Yeah.
But I just wonder, in determining whether an application condition is fulfilled, aren't you going to have to answer more existence questions? Isn't that circular and possibly leading to a regress?
Good question. I think in cases in which terms are descriptively defined, that'll certainly be the case. That one answering one will lead to the other, right? So if you want to know, are there bachelors in this room, or are there bachelors at all, then we got to find out, are there men who are unmarried, and then we got to figure out what the application conditions are for men and for unmarried, and so on. To avoid this kind of regress, I think we have to assume that there are some terms that have application conditions that can't be just stated in terms of other terms applying, right? That are sort of perhaps teachable through ostension, right? So when I say that a term has application conditions, I don't mean to say that there are conditions that can be, for its application, that can be fully stated in other terms of the language. I think that's just false anyway. I don't think that many of our terms in English are such that we can sort of fully state these application conditions. But I mean that there are circumstances in which, according to the sort of rules of use for the term that speakers apply, by applying and refusing the term on various occasions, by expressing bewilderment or understanding to other speakers, by nodding or shaking their heads, whatever. Now, there are circumstances in which it's proper to apply them, circumstances in which it's proper to refuse them. If we act on that assumption that there are, that that's all we're talking about with application conditions, right, then I think we don't get this kind of regress. So this is sort of fits in with the sort of standard approach to conceptual analysis, right, that's been defended by people like Chalmers and Jackson, that conceptual analysis proceeds not by trying to sort of define analytic and sufficient conditions for the application of a certain term, but rather by considering various situations, actual and hypothetical situations, are these ones in which the term would properly apply or not? Right? So if we don't have to assume this kind of definition of a term, I think we can avoid that problem.
So overall, I'm very sympathetic. I do want to encourage you to say a bit more about paraphrases, because then there's at least two quite different sorts of paraphrase techniques. We can think of sort of a synonymous paraphrase versus a corrective paraphrase.
Mm.
So, and I think if you think of sort of classic styles of paraphrase that you see, like you see adverbial style paraphrases in terms of like predicate functors or something like that. In terms of predicate functors, uh-huh. Fine zone technique and variables explained away. These are meaning equivalent. These are supposed to be synonymous. And your example of A and A star is, I don't think this is the best example, because actually the deep form of A actually involves an explicit reference
two of X, but never mind that. And this does look like a case of a synonymous paraphrase. But with fictive operators, I think these sorts of paraphrases are supposed to be corrective paraphrases. So if one says, like with the mathematical case, you know, or with the Holmes case, or whatever, you know, so take the math case, says this, you know, there are prime numbers, and that someone says, no, the paraphrase that says, according to the fiction of mathematics, there are prime numbers. You can't go backward. These aren't meaning equivalent.
Right.
So you can't say that you're sort of hiding your ontic commitment to numbers by invoking the corrective paraphrase of inserting the fictive operator in front. So it seems like there are these two two very different sorts of paraphrases, synonymous paraphrases and corrective paraphrases. And I completely agree with you that the synonymous paraphrases, you're just sort of shuffling, you're just sort of hiding your commitment under the carpet in certain cases. But I think there's still something needs to be said further, because this would encourage you to say something further, about what's wrong with certain kinds of corrective paraphrases.
Right, good, thanks. I forgot to discuss that in here. I do say a bit more about it in the book, but I mean, I at least have this section where I say, well, aren't paraphrases ever useful? And the kind of paraphrases that I consider as useful there are, I think, what you were calling the corrective paraphrases. So in cases like in the corrective paraphrase, we clearly, as you say, don't have a synonymy between the two. So what are the grounds for suggesting that we accept a certain corrective paraphrase? The normal use of paraphrases in discussions of ontology and to avoid ontological commitment is as a way, of course, everybody knows, as a way of preserving the sense in which things we want to say are true, that there are two chairs in the room, whatever, without committing ourselves to the relevant entities. That's what I think is illegitimate, if we preserved the sort of serious truthism. So when are paraphrases legitimate? I think the fiction case, this sort of non-controversial case, where we have a kind of legitimate paraphrase that's clearly not meaning preserving, what is it that makes it legitimate? I think these paraphrases are legitimate and have to be corrective in your sense when the original claim otherwise would commit us to a contradiction, to saying something obviously empirically false, was obviously involving a speaker mistake, that kind of thing. In those sorts of cases, right, so saying the detective that lived at Baker Street or whatever would be obviously empirically false, in those sorts of cases I think we do have grounds for introducing this kind of corrective paraphrase. There's another kind of certainty. Do you want to come back now before? I was just saying, there's another kind. So those, I clearly accept that kind of use of paraphrase. Whether any particular example, paraphrases of fictional paraphrases of mathematical terms, that's another question, right? You have to motivate it similarly, I think, for me, by showing that otherwise you would be committed to something obviously empirically false or contradictory or something like that. In the case of fiction, it's easy because there are these sort of implicit contradictions in what we say about fiction. Oh, the other cases in which I think you might legitimately use a corrective paraphrase would be cases in which, I think there's really a lot of what goes on in this kind of discussion of ontology, and I didn't say anything about it in this paper. Cases in which what the metaphysician is really doing is implicitly presupposing a whole new vocabulary, a whole new conceptual framework that would be perhaps more theoretically adequate in various ways, or cleaner, or have various theoretic virtues. And in that case, certainly, they can go right on to propose this kind of vocabulary, and we can evaluate on pragmatic grounds whether we should accept that or not. But I think, this is a sort of Carnapian side, that accepting that doesn't tell us anything about whether or not our original claims were straightforwardly true before we got the sort of corrective paraphrase that involves really introducing terms that have different rules of use and so a different conceptual framework.
Just to follow up a little bit about when to use the corrective paraphrase.
Yeah.
So there's at least three different cases. One sort of case is when we actually think that in the deep structure of what the speaker actually said, there actually lurked a covert fictive operator. And there's not really been corrected in any interesting sense. It's just that we the hearers might have been misled by the surface form into not thinking that there was the fictive operator really there all along.
Mm-hmm.
But a second sort of case, and maybe the fiction case is a bit more like that, is where we take a, that's what the speaker clearly meant, even if it wasn't what was said, so it's some sort of a clear sort of pragmatic implicature or something like that.
Right.
And there it's still what the speaker meant. But there's a third sort of case, and this is sort of a parochial, paternalistic paraphrase, where the speaker didn't say anything that had a covert fictive operator, and they didn't mean anything. That they didn't mean to have a fictive operator there, but we the theorists can understand that if you took what they said and what they meant on face value, then they're in contradiction,
right,
or something like that. And then we the theorists will choose to sort of stamp an according to the fiction operator in front of what they say. And it's interesting that once, if you do allow yourself the option of these kind of parochial corrective paraphrases in the case of contradictions and the like, then I'm kind of feeling like if you allow that, then you've left the door open for the Quinean to say it's not only in the case of contradiction when we want to insert sort of parochial corrective paraphrases, it's also in the case of ontological overcommitment. Why is contradiction so special would be a way of putting the point. Why not also say it's not only when the speaker's in contradiction, it's when she has the option of having an even more streamlined ontology. That's another case where where we'll be parochial and insert corrective paraphrase.
Okay, yeah, to that, I guess, I mean, I think there are much more neutral grounds on which we can defend the use of corrective paraphrase, parochially corrective paraphrase, in cases of contradiction or obvious empirical falsehood, than on Quinean grounds. So I think just on sort of strict principle of charity, right, seems that we should interpret speakers as saying something that's not self-contradictory or in violation of obvious facts. So that alone gives us grounds for doing this kind of parochially corrective paraphrase that we don't have for the Quinean case. Now, if you can, then how do I argue against the Quinean case? Against sort of expanding the circle in that kind of way. I can't think of any other way on the top of my head than by appealing to these kinds of simple transformative connections in ordinary speech.
But those were lacking in the corrective cases because they're not transformation equivalent. That was what distinguished the corrective from the
paraphrase. Right. So, sorry. So how do you... I mean, I guess in those cases... I'll just come back to the idea I had a minute ago that what you're doing really is, to say they're corrective, right? You're changing the application conditions for the terms, you're changing the language, and we need some sort of pragmatic reason for doing this. Right? The Quinean, I suppose, will say, yeah, the reason is to have it worse people in ontology.
When do you think of it as an extension of charity? And I don't care whether you consider it charity or an extension of charity. I'd say one way, among the ways of being charitable are, you know, don't impute contradictions, don't impute violations of obvious truths, and don't impute overblown ontologies.
I think that's
super charity. But now, why can't the Quinean say, I'm going to occasionally use corrective paraphrases of the parochial kind on grounds of super charity?
To the extent that principles of charity are supposed to fall out of general interpretive principles that we use in understanding each other at all, they're sort of non-philosophical in that sense. Falsehood just sort of brings them out. And I don't think there is any such principle of sort of not having an overblown ontology at work in the cases of sort of standard interpretation. On the contrary, given sort of normal rules of use of our terms, it seems like we have to interpret, you know, that it would be normally interpreted as saying something false if they said there are no chairs. And so on, if they had this kind of spare ontology. So at least to the extent that we can sort of, that what you've got to do if you're engaging in a kind of parochially corrective paraphrase is give grounds for tossing out what the speaker said and meant, substituting something else, right? Then if those grounds have to come from sort of standard interpretive principles that we do use in English, then maybe I can keep the quantity now on those grounds. I'll have to think about it. That's a really good case. So let me think some more about that.
You have a finger there?
Yeah, so in terms of Jonathan's useful terminology, I can see someone arguing that all paraphrases are correct to some degree because the paraphrase can never be fully equivalent. Equivalents are all have to have all the same entailments, whereas there will be some existential entailments that the paraphrase presumably doesn't have and the paraphrasee does have. So when you say Jimmy perceives red, it's supposed to follow, it does follow that there is something that Jimmy perceives, whereas when you say Jimmy perceives redly, it doesn't follow that there is something that Jimmy perceives. And so they are not going to be exactly equivalent. The two are not going to be meaning equivalent or definitely not have the same inferential role. Yeah. And yet, one is proposed as a paraphrase of the other. So this would be a kind of corrective paraphrase, even in the most sort of these adverbial cases that are the most paradigmatic of uses of paraphrase.
I certainly don't think that all the kinds of paraphrases that philosophers in these kinds of ontological debates have standardly used are such that they have sort of different meanings in the sense that the latter is not entailed by the former, right? And the kinds of examples I gave about paraphrases of claims about propositions, about ordinary objects and so on aren't like that. What about the adverbialist case? It's a little bit of a hard one, I think. I think it is open to someone to say that, look, the conditions under which you would apply the phrase John sees redly are just those conditions under which I would apply the phrase John sees red, an ordinary English speaker would. And so they really do have the same kinds of commitments. I mean, the case would have to be made in more detail, but I don't think it's obvious that they don't if you use this kind of application conditions approach. This is just a syntactical change, but not really a change in commitments about the world.
But there's an existential statement that follows from one and doesn't follow from the other. So if P entails R and Q doesn't entail R, then P and Q cannot be equivalent.
The challenge would be to figure out what the application conditions are supposed to be. I mean, what we've got here is you've dumped a noun term, right? In favor of an adverb. And I haven't said anything about the conditions under which adverbs apply. What the person who wants to collapse the two would have to do would be to show how the truth conditions, basically, for saying John perceives redly are the same as the truth conditions, or sufficient, at least, they don't have to be the same, but sufficient for John perceives red in the ordinary sense to be true. If that's the case, then John perceives redly just entails that John perceives red, and so we do then, at least according to this sort of standard of commitment, end up getting a sort of implicit commitment to redness. Now, whether this works, I don't know. I would have to really look at the way these terms are used by the adverbialist, the way terms about perception are used in ordinary discourse, and so on. If this kind of case can't be made out, then this may be a kind of really corrective paraphrase where we really don't have the same kinds of commitments at all. So I'd have to look more, I think, at the individual case and uses of terms.
Okay. Wolfgang. Just one. Was your finger? No, just one. Yes, you. No, wait a moment. Was your finger or hand? No, I don't know. Yes.
Was it a finger?
Was that a finger? You know the difference.
No, it was I was
hand. So I'm afraid that Wolfgang is
okay,
before. I'm sorry.
Wait, because it was a finger?
No, but he did that earlier than you.
Can I answer that? Is that the question?
I found it. I'm a bit worried that there's an ambiguity in your use of application conditions, and that in one sense it's far from clear that many of our nouns have application conditions associated with them. So the ambiguity would be between speakers have established truth conditions of sentences where the noun occurs, and that's one sense, and the other sense is the speakers have established some kind of real conditions such that X is an F if and only if it meets those conditions. So really conditions for reference of the noun.
Okay.
And I think in very many cases, especially of all the problematic entities you mentioned, it's far from clear that speakers have established like reference conditions of the second kind. So take the cases you even call obvious, like rules of games. We have take checkmate. So we have rules that tell us under which conditions it is true to say that the speaker is in checkmate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not clear that these rules tell us under which conditions an entity qualifies as a checkmate to which this player can stand in the relation of E and in net. It's far from clear that this is what the rules actually tell us. And I'm not sure what, give me three examples of a checkmate. I'm not sure if this question has a meaningful answer. I'm inclined to be kind of poignant here and say, no, really, there are no such things as checkmates. What we have is truths of the form player A is in checkmate, and if you want to know what that means, you can look it up in the rule book, and as you'll see, it doesn't mean that there's any special entity that the player is in, but rather it just means that the position of the game is in a certain state. So, and same for like money, as you notice, it's far from clear what it is to be a money, but it is clear what it is to possess money. So it seems that might be a case of the same kind, where we have truth conditions for sentences, fair enough, but it's far from clear that we have established any kind of reference conditions of our terms. And if we don't have that, I think it's much harder to get your argument going that of course there is money, of course there are collisions, of course there are checkmates. Maybe not. Maybe that's all just a figurative way of speaking, and if we want to know, before we do referential semantics, we have to translate it all so that we don't really have to find references for checkmate and for money, but rather only like references for the predicate being in checkmate and possessing money. And that's still an option that's, not for chairs and tables, there it seems clear that we have real reference conditions established, but for many of the more controversial entities, I think that's still a move that you haven't blocked to say, we don't really have these reference conditions, we only have truth conditions. Maybe we can actually systematize them better in a way where we don't quantify anymore over any entities that would play.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think for some kinds of terms, like checkmate, I think you're probably right. I mean, it's not clear it even makes sense to quantify over checkmates,
yeah,
right? That's part of the point, right? But there are a lot of these terms. All I need for my general point to work is for there to be a lot of cases like this, right? Including then for my specific points against specific arguments to work, of course, it has to be applied to those individual cases. But the trouble with checkmate, I think, is that, yeah, it's not clearly a sortal term at all. You can't say a checkmate, the checkmate. But for many of these cases that I'm talking about, institutional cases included, a debt, a law, etc., I think we do use this kind of quantificational talk about them, right? And I think we do have application conditions for the terms that are set up. I can tell you under what conditions there is a debt incurred, in what conditions there is a drunk driving law in a given state, and so on and so forth. And as long as you've got those, I mean, they're very sort of straightforward, right? They're sort of trivial and obvious. Then I think we should say that there are laws and debts and so on in the only sense that we should have ever expected there to be. Obviously, we want to avoid from that making such kind of category mistakes that are going to yield the wrong kinds of questions about these, like, you know, how much does the debt weigh, and so on, right? But in terms of actual saying, yeah, drunk driving laws exist in New South Wales or whatever, I think we do make these kinds of existence claims about them, we do make these kinds of quantificational claims, and these terms, I think, do have application conditions. And so we can address these kinds of existence questions in much the same way as we address the existence questions about tables, chairs, trees, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still not quite sure. So if we have real application conditions in the second sense for things like debt or law, because as you put it in terms of we know under which conditions a debt is, what was the word?
Incurred.
Yeah, so we don't have, so still now we have again a sentence, the debt is blah blah in just in case something else. But for a real reference condition, we would need something like X is a debt if and only if.
Let me clarify again what I mean by application conditions. Perhaps I didn't say this enough. To have application conditions, it doesn't require that there be some statement that's true of the form X is a K if and only if. In many cases, we may only be able to get a sort of sufficient entailment of existence. So if I borrowed money from a bank and signed this contract, there is a debt. Right? So it's that kind of application condition that I'm appealing to in suggesting that these kinds of social institutional terms actually have application conditions. I don't mean to presuppose that you can get a sentence of the form X is a K if and only if. And in quite a lot of cases, maybe most cases, maybe also for tables and chairs, we can only get sort of one way up in talents. And even then, they're not, as I said in response to one of the first questions, they don't have to be things that are stateable in language either. It can be like, looky here, here's a situation where there's a chair, it's clearly true.
I don't know. I think we have to stop here. I am very sorry. Okay, we have to thank the speaker.